For our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service now presents... The Indie Week, the independent weekly read today by John Federson, and our issue dated December the 4th of 2025. I think we can get going over at the Durham City Council because there are some new City Council members who have been sworn in. Deidreana Freeman and Mark Anthony Middleton were elected to council together in 2017. During their tenures, the pair have been strong advocates for Durham. Middleton led the effort to create Durham's guaranteed income program and has been the most consistent voice on council regarding gun violence, while Freeman described by Mayor Leonardo Williams as the city's equity watchdog, implemented numerous programs focused on leveling the playing field for all Durham residents, particularly those who don't have a platform. But policy misalignments and public spats that at times felt like siblings chiding each other at the dinner table often positioned Freeman and Middleton as combatants rather than colleagues, but the two were inextricably linked. Middleton said during Monday's City Council meeting, "Our careers have had a quantum entanglement over the years." 8 years later, the two walked off into the sunset after they addressed the public from the City Council dais for the final time Monday night. Residents, including a who's who of current and former public officials, packed City Hall to celebrate these careers of Freeman and Middleton and witness the passing of the torch to new City Council members elected last November to serve in their place. Mayor Williams honored both Freeman and Middleton with official city plaques in recognition of their service, after which the two outgoing councilors shared reflections on their careers. Freeman's interest in a political career began when she stumped for then-Senator Barack Obama and Senator Kay Hagan. Friends and peers encouraged her to take a deeper look into local public office, and she served on the Durham Planning Commission, a dependable pipeline for future city councilors before being elected to that council. City leadership has seen significant change in the 8 years since Freeman and Middleton took office. Three mayors, three city managers, two city attorneys, two city clerks, 13 council colleagues in total. Freeman says she clocked over 4.2 million minutes of service overseeing official city business with plenty of successes and pitfalls that come with being a public figure. Freeman said from the many 6-hour and 15-minute meetings to the rare 45-minute miracles, "I gained something unimaginable from this work." She thanked her husband and three children, who she said have grown up in this space, and shared her appreciation for staff and past colleagues like former Mayor Elaine O'Neill, who was in attendance. Freeman also had a fervent fan base in attendance who initiated call and response in celebration of her accomplishment, shouting, "We see you, Deidreana," and "We love you, Deidreana," throughout the evening, and delivered her flowers up at the dais. There were also organizers from the People's Table offering food and mutual aid supplies outside of City Hall during the meeting in honor of Freeman's work in the community. Middleton, who gave remarks following Freeman, joked that he was a bit salty about not receiving a bouquet of his own, saying, "I want to thank particularly the people of Abundant Hope Christian Church and my family. I see you out there. Where are my flowers at, Mon?" Middleton, originally from New York City, said his journey to the mayor pro tem seat was unlikely. Quote, "I was born in a neighborhood that was considered the crack capital of America. I fell asleep listening to Uzis go off in the park at night, and then I woke up in the morning and had to deal with yo mama jokes with a speech impediment. So some of the stuff I've dealt with in Durham politics has been adorable, comparatively speaking." Middleton was a polarizing figure, but he was well respected by his peers. serving as an ambassador for Bull City around the country and the mayor pro tem under O'Neill and Williams. Neither Freeman nor Middleton seemed prepared to give up community service, even if it meant operating from outside of City Hall as a private citizen. Freeman saying, "I have a deep love and respect for the people of Durham, far too much to say goodbye, so instead I'll say until next time, because the journey will continue." Middleton warned against the vitriol and antagonism that clouded this year's municipal elections, asking constituents to respect the humanity of, quote, eight exceptional people who sit on the dais, even if they don't agree with them on every vote. Middleton went on, "There is a germ in our public square where there are some folk who define themselves only by enemies. They can't conceive of a context of building without strife, without conflict, without rancor, almost as if they are afraid to operate in an environment of peace and mutual respect. So I want to say to the people of Durham, those of us that are in the overwhelming majority, resist. Rob it of its oxygen. Turn it off. Unplug it. It's time to govern." That responsibility now belongs in part to Freeman and Middleton's successors, that is, Matt Kopeck and Shanetta Burris. The two members were sworn in alongside returning councillor Chelsea Cook and Mayor Williams. Kopeck said he was excited to help build a Durham that is, quote, more affordable, more just, more sustainable, and hopefully with time one that is more united. Thank you to all the voters who trusted me enough to allow me to serve, and for everyone else, I ask you to give me a chance to earn your trust, because I desire to serve all of Durham. I'm particularly proud to be able to serve Ward 1 and intend to give my ward special attention as I seek to serve all of Durham in this role. Burris highlighted the camaraderie on the campaign trail between her and other candidates like Anjanae Bell and Pablo Friedman, who campaigned on Burris' behalf after the primary. She said she's ready to get to work and urged the community to hold her and the rest of the council accountable. "I'm here to serve our community," she said, "and to make sure those people are not voiceless." With the new council locked in, Williams appointed Javier Caballero as his next pro tem to replace Middleton, his fraternity brother and close confidant. Caballero, who was appointed in 2018, then elected in 19, is now the longest-serving city council member and the first person of Hispanic heritage to hold a position in Durham. Monday wasn't only about celebration. After the speeches, cheering, and photo ops, the city council still had the people's business to attend to, starting with addressing the large, unmarked SUV-sized elephant in the room, the prospect of federal immigration agents back in the Triangle. Siembra, NC, announced on Sunday the organization had credible information that ICE was launching a new month-long operation in the Triangle. An ICE spokesperson told Indy that was untrue. Council members spoke in strong opposition to the presence of ICE and CBP officers in Durham and uplifted numerous community organizations and volunteers on the front lines who distribute food and other resources to folks in need and those afraid to leave their homes. Councillor Nate Baker said, "Our immigrant communities are welcome here. We do not want immigration enforcement in Durham. I think that should be made loud and clear from all of us who believe that." In response to the fear and instability caused by federal agents last month, local organizers banded together to create the Durham Community Care Collective, a mobilization effort that raised thousands of dollars to provide meals for families across Durham. Councilor Carol Rist spent time with other volunteers loading blocks of ground beef from a walk-in freezer at the W.G. Pearson Center last week. He said, "I am so proud of this community for responding the way it has to tremendous concern about ICE here and families who literally did not want to go out to work or the store or to school." Mayor Pro Tem Caballero says the collective was pulled together quickly around the Thanksgiving holiday. She says the collective has raised over $100,000 and distributed meals to thousands of families with the help of teachers, guidance counselors, principals, and other volunteers across Durham who spent their holiday break bringing food to students and their families. Caballero says that is what Durham is. That's what Durham will always be, and I think it is in those moments when I see the deep strength and resilience of our community, and I see the deep commitment to neighbors. Council also got its first taste of collective governance on Monday when it deliberated over a small rezoning case in East Durham. After 25 minutes and a strange yet entertaining troll job from, quote, Jen Trifier, during public comment, the new city council voted unanimously in favor of that project. Well, what about immigration and these other agencies? ICE and CBP, similar mission, different MO. In the alphabet soup of government agencies, federal officers tasked with carrying out immigration law come in different flavors. ICE, ERO, CPB, HSI. Many Americans who now face unprecedented enforcement operations in their own backyards, most recently right here in North Carolina, are realizing that the agents detaining people aren't all the same. After this September 11, 2001 attacks, American politicians came face-to-face with a bleak realization of just how bad information sharing was between government bodies. Congress created the Department of Homeland Security as a superstructure for national security, a new monster cabinet that subsumed 22 other agencies and offices. It was almost like that foundational moment in Roman mythology when the god Saturn devoured his newborn sons. Containment, he believed, would one day prevent them from rising up and seizing power. Spoiler alert, that didn't work. During the formation of DHS, the government decided to shutter the Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS, a troubled agency that had handled an assortment of immigration issues for 70 years. It was the only entity that DHS completely dissolved. When INS died in March of 2003, the DHS birthed three sub-agencies to absorb its responsibilities, including two recently involved here in North Carolina, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and Customs and Border Protection, CBP. While both agencies handle aspects of immigration enforcement, their roles and responsibilities are supposed to be distinct. Last week, Operation Charlotte's Web, though, illustrated how their efforts are merging, leaving questions about what tactics are legal, who was detained, and where they were taken. ICE's primary task is to enforce the nation's patchwork quilt of immigration policies and laws across the interior. They investigate criminal activities related to immigration, trade, and national security, and are perhaps most widely known for removing people through deportation. ICE's mission, as it's currently worded, is, quote, protect America through criminal investigations and enforcing immigration laws to preserve national security and public safety. CBP's mandate is to manage, control, and protect the borders of the nation to prevent the unauthorized entry of people, drugs, and contraband. They do customs inspections, track down unauthorized border crossers, and staff ports of entry. Its mission, quote, protect the American people, safeguard our borders, and enhance the nation's economic prosperity. Both ICE and CBP serve as umbrellas for a number of sub-agencies. Within ICE, the two largest are Enforcement and Removal Operations, ERO, and Homeland Security Investigations, HSI. While CBPs are the Border Patrol and the Office of Field Operations. Government stats show ICE currently employs about 20,000 law enforcement agents and support personnel. CBP's total staff is roughly 60,000. Both agencies have a history of struggling to recruit and hire, faring even worse under Trump. Insiders have described the most recent ICE efforts to add 10,000 agents to his ranks as, quote, a shit show due to a lack of HR and support staff to make mass hiring possible. CBP's efforts to hire officers, meanwhile, have fallen short for more than a decade, according to the Government Accountability Office. Attrition among Border Patrol agents has outpaced hiring for years. Typically, most CBP operations occur at or along border crossings. Blue-uniformed CBP agents from the Office of Field Operations inspect agricultural and passenger imports, perform custom inspections on vehicles and goods, and try to prevent people from entering the country with fake papers or without authorization. They are trained in Georgia. The green-uniformed Border Patrol agents, who often call themselves the Mean Green and attend a paramilitary training academy in New Mexico, spend the majority of their time working on the swaths of land between official entry points to the U.S., searching for signs of people who entered the country illegally. Border Patrol agents are trained in tracking footprints, usually operate alone or in pairs, and can legally apprehend and search anyone without a warrant within 100 miles of America's land borders and coastline. That's about two-thirds of the country, and includes most major U.S. cities. Even though the Border Patrol agents aren't trained in community policing, they have a long history of being called in as backup to quell protests and domestic unrest, like as the desegregation of the University of Mississippi in 1962, the 1992 riots in Los Angeles, and the January 6th insurrection in Washington, D.C. in 2021. Under a September U.S. Supreme Court ruling, both CBP and ICE can legally use racial profiling to arrest people. When CBP agents apprehend someone, they are allowed to hold them for 72 hours before they must turn them over to ICE. The deadline, however, isn't always met. Interior operations are typically handled by ICE agents who conduct investigations, apprehend, detain, and deport people who admit or are found guilty of being in the country without authorization. ICE investigations generally involve going after known criminals and targeting transnational crime and smuggling networks. While they do not need judicial warrants to arrest those they suspect of being in the country without authorization, they do need these warrants to enter private residences and businesses. On the day he took office, Trump issued an executive order diverting ICE's investigative focus from crimes like child pornography, human trafficking, and antiques fraud to enforcing basic immigration laws, quote, and other federal laws related to the illegal entry and unlawful presence of aliens. Once an individual is in ICE custody, they can remain there for months, if not years. ICE currently has 131 facilities and contracts with a network of local law enforcement in 40 states to detain immigrants. It's the largest immigrant detention system in the world, and capacity grew by 75% between 2005 and 2015. Since taking office for his second term, Trump has reopened ICE detention centers that had been closed since 2021 due to, quote, alarming conditions and substandard care. When making arrests, Border Patrol agent and ICE agent attire can be differentiated or at times hard to distinguish. ICE doesn't have a uniform or a dress code. Agents sometimes wear tactical vests and helmets. Often they dress in plain clothes and look like civilians. The Border Patrol isn't afforded that same sartorial flexibility. They maintain a strict dress code, and agents can be punished for breaking rules that include long-debated standards like facial hair, fingernail length, and makeup. Border Patrol rough duty uniforms are typically green, but they also have dress uniforms. Some units have tactical camo, and they can also dress as civilians for undercover work. Both ICE and CBP answer to in-house teams dedicated to internal investigation called the Office of Professional Responsibility, which investigates agents included or accused of wrongdoing and can issue disciplinary recommendations. Yet accountability has been a proven challenge for both agencies, reported the GAO in 2018. Out of 23,000-plus reported incidents, more than half at CBP, more than two-thirds of ICE misconduct cases resulted in no action or were not referred to for adjudication. GAO also found that neither agency consistently documented the findings of misconduct investigations. Both ICE and CBP have struggled with record-keeping and data management. The cultures inside these two divisions are distinct. That's another reason that Operation Charlotte's Web looked different than what people might expect from ICE. Border Patrol carries a century-old reputation for cowboy-style independence, resistant to oversight and corruption. A DHS official told NBC News in October, the administration thinks ICE isn't getting the job done, so CBP will do it. In Charlotte and in the Triangle, that looked like caravans of unmarked cars, trucks, and minivans carrying agents who concealed their identities with balaclavas and masks. Many vehicles lacked government plates. Most CBP and ICE agents couldn't be identified by name or badge numbers unless asked. Many of those apprehended were sent to CBP detention and untrackable until they were transferred to ICE custody days later. Under pressure to hit these quotas of 3,000 a day and working more closely together, ICE and CBP personnel are difficult to distinguish, even to some insiders. Former acting ICE director John Sandwick told Politico last month, it's not always clear to me, whether it's ICE, Border Patrol, or even what's called Federal Protective Service. That's the law enforcement DHS agency that protects federal buildings. Lawyers for the Trump administration have denied quotas for detaining or deporting immigrants exist. Currently, around 8,500 ICE enforcement and removal operations officers are working with approximately 1,500 Border Patrol agents dispatched to American cities to make arrests. NBC News reported last month the administration plans to replace, quote, at least half of ICE leaders with Border Patrol officials, citing disappointment with arrest numbers. DHS said at the time it had, quote, no personnel changes to announce. Community activist Pedro Rios, director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico border program, in a recent op-ed said this. Once complete, Border Patrol's power grab of its sister agency will likely mark a dramatic shift in how immigration agents conduct arrests. Under Trump, Department of Homeland Security has morphed to accommodate his focus on immigration. More than half its annual budget is now projected to fund immigration activities in the coming years, according to a recent New York Times analysis. ICE's budget is expected to nearly triple. In its section on DHS, the conservative plan, Project 2025, called for dismantling it entirely in order to set up a mega agency focused on immigration. It proposed combining CBP and ICE to start, then subsuming all other agencies that touch immigration. In short, CBP's takeover might not stop with ICE. In Roman mythology, Jupiter went on to reign after overthrowing his father, Saturn. Will DHS meet the same fate amid Border Patrol's rise? Related article. The immigrant advocacy group Siembra, North Carolina, announced on Sunday it had received, quote, multiple creditable reports that U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, would send 50 agents to the Raleigh area this week for a new month-long operation. On Monday morning, a Siembra spokesperson told Indy they could not provide the source of the new information, quote, just that we trust it. They added Siembra NC believes the operation will just be ICE with no U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, which detained at least a dozen people in the Triangle on November 18th. Siembra has been leading the effort to track and verify immigration agent sightings in North Carolina over the past month and hosts training for individuals and businesses year-round on their First and Fourth Amendment rights. ICE Public Affairs spokesperson Lindsay Williams denied Siembra's report, but left plenty of ambiguity about the agency's plan for the Triangle. Williams said, "We do operations in Raleigh and the Triangle area every day, 7 days a week. Nobody knows our plans, and whomever their source is incorrect. We do stuff as we see fit or need to. So today, 200 people could show up and do something and then leave or whatever. It's fluid. We do planned operations that require extra people and stuff, but the public wouldn't be privy to that." Siembra said in its press release that it doesn't know specifically who or where ICE will target. The group noted ICE agents have rarely made the kind of racial profiling snatch and grab that the Border Patrol conducts regularly. A map maintained by Siembra showed no new verified sightings of agents in the Triangle as of this Monday afternoon. Triangle area elected officials told Indy on Monday they couldn't confirm or deny Siembra's report because ICE is not required to notify local law enforcement of its plans. Raleigh Mayor Janet Cowell told Indy Monday morning she had not received any information that would confirm that report. Wake County Sheriff Willie Rowe released a statement Monday saying his office had not received any new information from ICE, but, quote, presence of ICE personnel in Wake County is not new. This is true. ICE has a small building in Cary. Rowe said the sheriff's office does not coordinate with ICE or conduct its own immigration enforcement. He asked residents, quote, not to engage with or confront ICE personnel and allow them to carry out their official duties. In contrast, groups like Siembra and Ready the Ground training team are teaching volunteers to spot information agents, blow immigration agents, blow whistles to alert others, film interactions, and ask to see judicial warrants. Parentheses, when Rowe, a Democrat, was elected in 22, he pledged not to reinstate Wake County's 287G ICE collaboration agreement. He told Indy at the time the program did, quote, more harm than good. A spokesperson for the Durham County Sheriff's said on Monday afternoon the office is not aware of planned ICE activity in Durham this month. We are not informed prior to any such ICE or CBP operations being initiated in local jurisdictions, the spokesperson wrote in an email. Durham Mayor Leonardo Williams wrote in an email to Indy Monday evening his office has been in touch with local law enforcement and Governor Josh Stein's office, quote, but no one has been able to confirm whether federal operations will continue this week or in the near future. Williams added the city officials are working to get more information, but for now, residents should stay alert and prepared for any developments. The Durham Police Department was not involved in last month's CBP activity and is not involved in enforcing federal immigration laws. CBP briefly ramped up its Triangle operations in mid-November, detaining at least 12 people. During that time, tens of thousands of K-12 students stayed home from school and adults reportedly called out from work en masse. While ICE and CBP have similar mandates, as I've already read, and overlapping responsibilities, CBP agents have a reputation for misconduct and using especially aggressive tactics. Siembra NC co-director Nikki Baina wrote, We know this news may cause alarm, but we do not have information that suggests ICE is planning the same kinds of arrests as those conducted by CBP last week, and we hope they decide to change their plans before they are put into motion. North Carolina school children and parents do not need to be subjected to more chaos by federal law enforcement agents, invited here by State House Speaker Destin Hall. Hall told the News and Observer in late November that federal agents were doing, quote, a pretty good job, and he wanted them to come back to North Carolina. We have a chance now to read some artistic, creative articles. And the first one is about performance artist and writer Taylor Mack. When Taylor Mack started working on a holiday show nearly a decade ago, something didn't feel right about it. I just wasn't into it, said Mack, who uses the gender pronoun Judy, J-U-D-Y. But then Mack's mentor and drag mother, Mother Flawless Sabrina, passed away. Suddenly, quote, I really just wanted to make a show about her, Judy said. The show that emerged is both a holiday cabaret and a deeply felt tribute to a queer elder, a raucous and subversive acid trip, and a sincere attempt to reclaim and preserve the parts of the holiday season that have not been fully eroded by capitalism and forced domesticity. Called Holiday Sauce, a reference to one of the Mother Flawless favorite proverbs, you're the boss, applesauce. That show has been an annual tradition since 2017 and will tour to Duke Arts Presents December 4th through 6th. I'm recording this on Thursday the 4th. So it's through the weekend. Mack, a Pulitzer Prize finalist and a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, is no stranger to the Triangle stages. A section of Judy's marathon work, A 24-Decade History of Popular Music, toured to Carolina Performing Arts in 2014, and Mack once performed Judy's one-person show, The Young Ladies of... at Playmakers Repertory Company. While passing a kidney stone, I assume that means Mack was once passing a kidney stone. During this trip, Mack will blessedly be getting to know Durham's queer elders instead of its emergency rooms. Wherever Holiday Sauce tours, Mack has a tradition of working with the local community to identify elders to honor during the show. When we spoke, the author of this column writes, Durham honorees were still being confirmed. Other elements of the show change every year, and Mack is tight-lipped about what Durham audiences will see, but it's probably safe to count on some Christmas standards like you've never heard them before. Some covers of songs that, on the surface, have a little to do with the holidays. Think The Velvet Underground, Frank Ocean, and The Rolling Stones, and at least one Mack original, equally heartbreaking and hilarious. Mack says, putting together holiday music and Velvet Underground songs, there's something very liberating about that expansiveness. That's what's fun for me, not having to compartmentalize. Other holiday sauce staples include costumes by maximalist genius Machine Dazzle. The critics described one of them as a Christmas tree ornament made by Picasso on an absinthe bender. Special guest appearances, sexual consent Santa sometimes makes a showing, and lots of audience participation. Mack called it all a feast of humanity, which feels apt. We'll hopefully make you laugh and make you feel closer to each other, Judy said. That's the hope. Now there are some Q&A sessions. Tell me about your relationship historically to these holidays and how that has changed since you started Holiday Sauce. Judy answers, I didn't enjoy the holidays. As I got older, I realized the holidays were fraught with a lot of family tension and a lot of unresolved anger. And then as you become responsible financially, you start to see how detrimental capitalism is to most of our lives. As a queer person, it's challenging to navigate the religious aspects of the holiday, not to mention the family aspects, when family members aren't in support of your queerness. So the holidays became a very oppressive experience for me for most of my childhood. It wasn't until I started hanging out with a chosen family that I enjoyed the holidays. Doing this show has been liberating. I haven't seen some of the band members since the last holiday, so it's a little bit like family that lives in other places. It's great to get everybody in the same room together again to have fun and make music together. The music has always been the best part of the holiday season for me, so now it's something I look forward to instead of roll my eyes at. Question: were there pieces of holiday culture, music, and shows that were a reprieve during those times and that shaped you in this show? The best part for me was caroling. The lights are pretty. There's a kind of beauty to it all. The interesting thing is to me about the holiday, for a lot of people, it's this combination of torture and joy. It's very hard to reconcile all that. And I think that's really what our show is about, acknowledging this reality and leaning more toward the joy of it, rather than being overwhelmed by the horror of it. My drag mother, Mother Flawless Sabrina, would say, "You're the boss, applesauce." What she meant by that was, we're in charge of our own lives. If there's something that tortures you every year, how could you shift it? How could you reframe it? How can you deconstruct it and use the parts that are good? That's part of what we're doing with the show. The other part is that as a queer person growing up during the height of AIDS, there's a lot of sardonic humor that I've developed, partly as a defense and partly because it's fun. Combining that sardonic humor with the earnestness of the holidays, because I am also a fairly sincere person, is interesting to me. It makes a great night out where you're not ignoring the world and you're not packing away a part of your personality during the holiday season because it's not appropriate. Question: if there's something that tortures you, how can you shift it? How can you refine it? Instead, it's like, why don't we unpack it and let it be in the world? And maybe there's a way to take some of the sincerity and earnestness from the season into the rest of the year, too, because we've all gotten so cool and sarcastic and ironic. There's a lot of eye-rolling in the world and a lot of anger in the world. You mentioned Mother Flawless Sabrina, to whom this show is dedicated. Tell me more about her. She was a nativity scene. She was a theatrical Christmas pageant. My favorite Christmas was the year she invited me over. It was a wonderful bohemian party, and I thought, it can be fun. So it's fun to share her story. She had over 200 full-time employees for her drag pageants that she had started in the late 50s. They would go all over the country, even the Bible Belt and the Rust Belt, all the places that people would say you wouldn't go drag. It was like RuPaul, 40 years before RuPaul. She led a very impressive life and was such a wonderful den mother for us all. Do you have any advice or wisdom for folks, especially queer folks, who are dreading the holidays this year? Come hang out with us. It doesn't have to be torture. I love sharing Mother Flawless's advice. You're the boss, applesauce. Make the life that you want to have. No one's forcing you to have a turkey dinner. If you're going to family and they don't love you, you're choosing to do that, and maybe that's the right choice. And isn't that fun? You know you're making the right choice, because it's radical empathy and radical love. It's not always easy, but it's such a great place to live from. My entire life, my mother couldn't embrace my queerness. It was very hard for her. She's passed now, and I'm sorry for her that she could never get there. But I have a lot of pride that I kept at it with her. I just kept digging. I lived my best life with her, even if she was not able to live hers. So there's something wonderful about putting out that olive branch. Just keep doing it, because it's good for you. It stopped being about her. It was good for me. But also, balance. I stopped spending Christmas with her, that's for sure. I would see her around the holidays on Christmas Day, though, I wanted to be with my husband and the band. That made my life better. Once again, this column about Taylor Mack appearing at Duke Arts Presents, December 4 through 6. And another musical article, also a book release published by UNC Press coming out, How Alice Girard and Hazel Dickens Became a Bluegrass Duo. This is an excerpt from the book Custom Made Woman, A Life in Traditional Music, written by Alice Girard and published this month. The release event is December 2nd, or was at Cat's Cradle. This is the excerpt. "That's for me to you and for me to know and you to find out," Hazel Dickens said when someone would ask her age. "We used to be a family in our little cabin home, whose windows they are broken and whose chimneys dark and cold. But jobs were hard to find back then. It wasn't easy to survive. So one by one, we all left home to change our way of life. You gave me a song of a place that I call home, a song of now, a song of then, a song of yet to come." That was an excerpt from You Gave Me a Song, Words and Music by Alice Girard. "There are a lot of memories that are pretty foggy, but I remember one in particular when Jeremy said to me in early 1953, 'There's this little skinny girl with a great big voice that you've got to meet.' Meet her I did, and we shared a musical partnership for many years. Hazel Dickens was born in a coal mining area around Mercer County, West Virginia, in 1925, and had moved gradually with much of her family to Baltimore after World War II. Like many other Southerners, they hoped to find better work and a better life, and Hazel worked as a waitress and in factories like Continental Can and Dixie Cup. She was shy, very self-conscious, aware of her lack of formal education, her accent, clothing, and many of the cultural differences that set her apart. She told me about the time someone made fun of her for calling Pepsi and Coke pop instead of soda. Just one of a thousand cuts. Country music is full of songs about leaving the country for the city, hard times in the city, not finding a better life there, longing for home, disillusion, and breakup of families. These songs are staples of country music. Streets of Baltimore and Detroit City are two that come to mind. I wrote on the subject in my song, Sky Over Michigan. I traded quiet country evenings for bright city sounds, hard work and worry for hard work and doubt. And this dirty old factory job in Detroit town is a far cry from a glass slipper and a satin ball gown." By coincidence, Hazel met Mike Seeger when he was working at a tuberculosis sanitarium outside of Baltimore, where one of her brothers was a patient. Through Mike Seeger, she met other people, including Alcie Taubman, a kind of lefty bohemian social worker and music lover who took Hazel under her wing, encouraging her to believe in herself. She became a strong mentor and important friend to Hazel. I believe I first met Hazel at one of many music parties at Alice's apartment in Baltimore. Hazel had a wicked sense of humor and a twinkle in her eye. She didn't immediately trust anyone and liked keeping her business to herself. Country smart, she'd grown up hard and poor. Her father, H.N. Hillary Dickens, was a powerful singer and banjo player, but gave the banjo up when he joined a primitive Baptist church in his early 20s. Later, Mike Seeger recorded Hillary's singing and banjo playing for the album Old Time Tunes of the South on Folkways Records. Hazel's mother was a quiet, sweet woman, very deferential to her husband, and not a singer or musician that I can remember, although most of Hazel's 11 siblings did sing and played. She had a singing voice that could nail you to a wall, the kind of voice that embodied the high, lonesome sound to me. She played guitar and bass well enough to occasionally fill in with some local bluegrass band at some random bar gig. But it was that voice, edgy, piercing, high, lonesome, cutting, and raw, Hers was an oasis in the desert of pretty, sweet voices emerging during that folk revival of the late 50s and early 1960s. I was in awe of Hazel's singing, trying to grasp hold of its mysterious power for a long time, listening to her, looking to her as a mentor, learning from her. She was older, generally streetwise and street smart, in this world of music and bridging cultures. With her innately suspicious and private nature, she knew what was best. We gradually became friends, and when at some point someone at some music party suggested we try singing together, it seemed like a good idea. It was always informal, and we never considered that we might take it further. Our recording's career started with another party, as I remember, where Peter Siegel was present. He was a young music enthusiast from New York who was heavily involved in the New York City folk scene as both musician and engineer during the early 60s. Both Peter's and my memories are a bit hazy about the circumstance, but between the two of us, we remember that he and his friend David Grisman, both in their late teens, that's Grisman, the mandolin soloist, had come down to D.C. from New York to attend a bluegrass festival that got rained out. Somehow, Pete and David ended up at a music party at my cousin's house on the edge of Georgetown. Hazel and I were there, and of course, we were stinging. I checked the notes to Pioneering Women of Bluegrass, where both Hazel and I, as well as Peter, remembered some of the details. Peter saying, "I heard you guys sing in the kitchen, and I thought you were great singers, and I was totally knocked out." David said, "I remember singing on the floor and singing." David and Peter asked if we'd ever thought of recording. David said we need to get a tape together, and he would speak to Moses Ash, owner of Folkways Records. We recorded that demo tape in Pete Kuykendall's basement. Peter thinks Mike Seeger, who had recorded several LPs of traditional music for Folkways, had a good business relationship with Mo Ash, also put in a good word for us. Mo, a Polish immigrant and son of writer Sholem Ash, founded Folkways in 1948 in New York City. The label was known for putting out huge collections of rare, little-known music and spoken word recordings of all kinds. He recorded the world, as someone recently noted. Some of these recordings became classics and were revered around the world. Lead Belly, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Ella Jenkins, and countless others. Others remained known to few or to specialized audiences, but all were available and remain so to this day through Smithsonian Folkways recordings. Given Moe's wide and varied taste and perhaps a little prodding from Mike, he agreed to put out a recording of Hazel and Alice. I found a contract that I think is for the first recording of Hazel Dickens and Alice Foster, that was me, dated November 17, 1965. From what I can tell, we were paid $200 with a $75 advance against royalties of 25 cents for each album sold. We were thrilled. Our first recording. Our good friend Lamar Greer would play banjo, Hazel the bass, David Grisman the mandolin, and I guitar. All we needed was a fiddler. Robert Russell Chubby Wise, a well-known bluegrass fiddler who had played and recorded with Bill Monroe, among others, happened to be living in the D.C. area at the time, playing at the famous Bar and Grill across from the Trailways Bus Depot in downtown Washington. Jeremy thought it would be quite a coup if we could get Chubby to play with us on the recording, but we had never met him. Tom Morgan, a close friend and fellow musician who did know him, gave him a call. Tom said, "I have some friends who are trying to cut an album. Would you be kind enough to help them out?" I like to have dropped my teeth when Chubby said, "Yeah, I'll do it." He was congenial and supportive. He was indeed chubby, happy, smiling a lot, and all about getting the job done. This was before Pro Tools. As Peter remembered, it was one AKG D24 microphone, a borrowed Nagra 3P tape recorder, acetate tape, borrowed speakers, so Peter could play the takes back for us to hear, and mostly one or two take songs. Peter remembers that Mo Ash gave him $75 to make the recording, $37.50 so he could buy tape, and a bus ticket, and the other $37.50 when he had finished. "I thought it was big time," he said. "I bought 12 reels of tape and a bus ticket." Hazel and I were busy planning that recording, choosing material, and practicing. It was during this time, in September 64, that Jeremy was killed. Peter remembers wondering whether we'd go through with the recording or not, but we did, probably in 1965, with a lot of help and support from many friends. We recorded in Pierce Hall, part of the All Souls Unitarian Church at 14th and Harvard Street in Northwest D.C., a hall known by music people for its good acoustics. Hazel remembered it cost $50 to rent. Hazel and I recorded a second album for Folkways shortly after the first one, Won't You Come and Sing With Me. It wasn't released till 1973, at about the same time we released our first Rounder Records album. My friend Betsy Siggins took a number of wonderful photos of Hazel and me at this time, which we used for the covers of Won't You Come and Sing For Me. I remember those photo sessions, lots of messing around, indoors and out, trying different backgrounds, lighting, props, outfits. She had cool old furniture in her house, and lots of old pieces of clothing, bows, peacock feathers, net stockings, cigarette holders, and the like, that we worked with when we got fed up with playing it straight. Why not mess around? Put three creative women together with camera and props, and watch out. And again, this was a long excerpts from the book, Custom Made Woman, A Life in Traditional Music, written by Alice Gerard, and published this month by UNC Press. Just released on December the 2nd at Cat's Cradle. UNC Press would be the source, I guess, if you want to pick up a copy. All right, I have time to do most of one final article today. How do triangle singles date these days? For some, it involves getting shipped. Jerush Christopher, a recent graduate of NC State University, knows firsthand that young people can struggle with dating. He tells the Indy, dating apps suck. It's so much easier just to talk to someone in person and have your first conversation in real life. He's not the only one who feels this way. About half U.S. adults under 30 report having used a dating site or app, and only about half of all these users report having a positive experience. And because the only way to fight a bad dating app is, of course, create a better dating app. And Christopher did just that. This app serves as a sort of a speed dating host. After you make a profile, it'll match you with someone in the room and can even give you some suggestions for icebreakers based on your common interest. Some ship events, SHIPP, spread across the triangle have attracted as many as 80 singles. There is a smaller turnout on a Saturday afternoon when I stop by DSSLVR, where about 20 Halloween costume young people, including a reindeer and a male Slytherin and a female Gryffindor, who seem to have come separately but have struck up a conversation near the bar, mix and match. A 34-year-old man in a moppish wig and a coconut bra, I'm told he's Ula from Adam Sandler's 51st Dates, and I agree to refer to him and his other interviewees by costume name in only exchange for their honest opinion on modern dating. Tells me he's here because he likes to meet women organically. He's never been to a singles mixer before, and he's also never been on a traditional dating app. Ula says, the idea of swiping and pulling together a profile and trying to discern whether this is a person you'd like to meet based on a photo and a little description does not appeal to me in any capacity. So this just seemed like a nice hybrid of meeting people in real life with the use of technology. Ula, though, hasn't even been checking ship at the event. He's just naturally mingling through the room. That seems to be the case for most people. When I log on to ship, I answer a few basic questions about myself, writes Chase Pellegrini. Answer these few basic questions: age, gender, orientation, interest, family plans, and am instructed to hang out and make some friends while I wait for a match. Soon, my phone's flashlight strobes as the app enthusiastically informs me I have a match. The sleek interface seems all too shameless when seconds later it clarifies, sorry, your match canceled. It seems clear this is a software glitch, but after it happens a second time, I decide to prioritize my career and find some more interview subjects instead of seeking another match. Ula tells me the problem with online dating is it gives the sense there's a better option out there or that there's this limitless supply. At least in a bar with Ship, you can't pretend that a better option is just a swipe away. His friend, dressed as a loan shark, shark costume holding a paper with terms of a predatory loan, says he'd been to one Ship event before and actually met someone with whom he ended up in a four-month relationship. Loan Shark says, today, I haven't gotten a single match. It's been broken, or at least it's been offering me friendship matches, which is not what I'm here for. The app dutifully offers friendship matches to the spares in the room when the gender ratio is off. Both Ula and Loan Shark are also members of a running club, which tracks. Running club recently stampeded into notoriety and meme-oriety as opportunities for athletic singles to find that perfect partner for 5Ks and beyond. On any Durham weeknight, it's not uncommon to feel a downtown sidewalk shaking as a fleet of polyester-clad enthusiasts trot by. As the loan shark and I chat, I see the beginnings of what may be a Ship success story. A mermaid in long red dress and seashell earrings is making her way across the bar, seemingly led by the app, to talk to a man in a plaid shirt who has been diligently working the room at the behest of the software. After a few minutes of chatting, the mermaid and the man plaid do a few steps of a swing dance, laughing and stepping close to each other. Loan Shark tells me, not unjealously, I've been trying to talk to that girl for ages. All right, folks, the music is telling me I have to stop. This article came out at the end of October. I've kept it in my folder for cases when I need a filler, so to speak. But it's an intriguing article, and I will reread it for myself on their website, which is indieweek.com. And that's a free website where one can read loads and loads of back issues and search for other articles in all these areas that The Independent is known for. And John Fetterson then will be back next Thursday, I believe, for another issue of Indie Week from the ncreadingservice.org. That's where you'll find this podcast at our podcast section after the Friday broadcast. John Fetterson for Indie Week saying farewell.